at our next stop, I just pulled over and pulled out the phone and I made a voice memo of me saying that.
I'm MK Anderson, and this is First 100 Days. A podcast where we discuss the idea that if the first 100 days of a presidency are so important, they're likely to be important for anybody else's career and life moves. We'll talk to CEOs, first-time parents, startup bros, and more to discover if the first 100 days are really that important. Dan Chmielinski is the composer and musical talent behind the original music of this podcast. He went to Juilliard for bass performance and now performs all around New York and the world and composes for various projects, most notably the movie Nectar out now. Today, we're going to chat about what the composing and collaboration process was like for this theme music. Well, Shimmy, thanks so much for being with us today. How's it going?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, Shimmy, I am so excited to chat with you because many don't know this, but we went to high school together, and so it has been so fun to see your path throughout the years and see all that you've been up to. But I got to admit, I don't really 100% understand the career trajectory and the life path that comes from being a musician, especially since you do so many things, you know, performing and composing and accompanying and all that jazz. So if you wouldn't mind just giving us a little bit of background into what it is that you do and how one, you know, gets into this world of music and what that path might look like.
Well, and music's one of those careers where, you know, you can kind of travel down multiple roads at the same time. And that's something I've really been fortunate to be able to do. My background is preliminary as a bassist, and I've played jazz pretty much my entire life, and that's what I specialized in at Juilliard and make most of my living doing, you know, playing jazz on the scene and playing bass for a multitude of genres. But I would say probably into my first or second year of Juilliard, I started really exploring composing, and, you know, I've always composed music. Composing has always been at the forefront of everything I do, all of my projects, all of the bands I lead. I like to compose all the music for them myself. But it wasn't really till that year that I started realizing that I could take classes to further my understanding of it and work with mentors on how to get better at composing and how better to translate emotion into music. And so that was really an integral year for me in terms of just really coming to understanding how I can use composing to further express my voice, right? Because as a bassist, I'm always expressing my voice from note to note. Everything is improvised and adapted on the spot. And so, you know, I have to be organic 100% of the time, or, you know, I'm not going to get very many calls. So doing the same thing in a little more prepared fashion is really the love and joy that I find in composing. And so I've led bands. I have a couple groups of my own. I've been a part of other people's projects. I've toured as a bassist. But I would say probably the first film score that I did, where I knew that this was a major part of what I wanted to do in my life, was actually my last year of high school with a mutual friend that we both know, Connor Smith, who's a wonderful director, also now based in New York, and was my roommate here for a couple of years. He did a feature-length film. And if you know anything about the composing world and film scoring specifically, features are kind of hard to come by. And, you know, to have that be my first gig was really, really eye-opening because he did this film called Smoke in the Air, which was a great, great film. Did it basically over the course of the summer. And I got the honor of scoring that. And it was a lot of music and a lot of cues. And I really didn't know a lot about film scoring, but I realized I had such a fun time doing it and working with him and working with a medium that's not music and being able to kind of express my musical voice in something that is preliminary visual. You know, that really, really changed my perspective on the possibilities of film scoring, what you can do with it, what kind of impact you can have with it. And from that point on, I've gone on to score features, documentaries, shorts since then, commercial stuff. And ever since then, it's just kind of been an evolution of how I can do that more and more by expanding my palette sonically and with different instruments. And so, you know, I would have to say it all goes back to that film because that was the first time I realized how much I enjoyed it. And ever since then, it's just been kind of a continued exploration for me as to how I can push my limits, learn more about creating music, work with more musicians, more types of musicians. And so it's really just a beautiful path that kind of has allowed me to really integrate my voice and my musical, ideas in a different way.
You said you took classes at Juilliard for film scoring, and that is really what, you know, drove your energy into pursuing this even more. What are some of those things that you're even learning in these classes? Because music is so subjective and could be, you know, transcribed in so many different ways, depending on the film or the project you're working on.
Yeah, so scoring is kind of multifaceted in the sense that there's a technical side to it, which has a lot to do with, what kind of, things you need to know in terms of making the actual project. So, you know, the technology side. Then there's the theory side of it, which is, can you compose a piece of music and what goes into actually creating a meaningful piece of music? And then there's the actual scoring side of it, which is what's specific to film scoring that's different from any kind of other composing. So the first course that I took at Juilliard was a production course, and that really heightened my awareness in terms of what's available in terms of, just the technology side of things. So what kind of programs you can work in, what kind of samples you have access to, just the nitty-gritty of technology and how that all plays a factor into your final score. So that was the first thing I took. And that was really, really interesting to me because it got me into a lot of different avenues that I would not have found naturally. You know, music technology is this wide, wide world that, you know, spawns from basically early, you know, synthesizers and, you know, very early sampling to, you know, now where everybody has a copy of, you know, Apple Logic on their computer and can, you know, basically do what couldn't be done without a recording studio 10, you know, even less years ago. It gives this incredible amount of control. And I think, you know, that really opened my eyes in terms of what I could do from my own home. Then there's the theory side of it, which I studied with a couple different composers. Ed Billos was the film scoring teacher at Juilliard, but I also studied with Kendall Briggs, who's an amazing composer there, and Philip Lasser, who's another amazing composer. I studied with Kendall Briggs independently, and I studied with Philip Lasser in a class called Composition for Non-Majors, which is really for people that are not composition majors, but want to learn more about composing. So that class was really big for me in terms of just kind of understanding the theory side of composition. And then there's film scoring itself, which I did take a film scoring class at Juilliard with Ed Billos, but I also took a really impactful course a couple summers back through BMI, which is my performing rights organization. And BMI puts on a workshop every year. A guy that has kind of just been a staple in the scoring scene named Rick Bates leads this composition for screen 6-week thing. You have to apply for it. I think only 9 or 10 of us were accepted into it. And it was people from all ages, all backgrounds. And basically what we did is we looked at film scores from the past that, you know, are kind of idolized as really iconic scores or composers that are iconic, and broke down how they handled very specific scenes. And then we were actually given scenes from existing movies with existing scores, but with the scores removed. So we actually had to score to the picture, either having heard or not heard the score that was existing, and try and interpret it in our way. And I think that is the thing that I love most about film scoring, is the interpretational side of it, right? Because, you know, as you said, emotions are so, very up in the air. You know, there's nothing that says like, oh, this chord is going to absolutely make everybody feel this way. Like, no, it's interpretational. And, you know, as a bassist, I deal with that from a note to note, interface with a band, right? Because it's my job to kind of keep the equilibrium of what's happening on a bandstand. And, you know, I can shape a piece based on what I do. And so film scoring is kind of a larger, more grandiose way of doing that. My palette of instruments is larger. My timeline of development is larger. I can segment it any way I want. And so, you know, it really scratches a lot of the same itches that, you know, really made me fall in love with playing the bass, especially in a jazz setting. And, you know, that interpretational side is something that really can't be taught, because that's what's going to ultimately make your cues and your scores different from someone else's, is how you interpret that emotion and how you convey it musically.
Right. So then, before we start chatting about how we even collaborated on what this podcast sounds like, because I think that would be really cool for people to listen to, is like, oh, I've been listening to this intro. Let's talk about how that even gets broken down. But before we do that, I'm really interested in how do people even break into the film composing world, right? So yeah. I know that you compose things because I know you personally, but like how is that something people break into per se? How did people even get into Juilliard for that? I feel like that's not, you know, people don't do that in high school, you know, like it's not like a typical music career that you would know the path of, right?
Well, one point of clarification, you can't major in film scoring at Juilliard.
Gotcha.
Composition is its own major, and actually the technology course and the film composition course are separate from the composition department. They actually fall in an independent department called the Center of Innovative Arts. And it's completely dedicated to music technology. And actually not many people in the school even know it exists. And so I was very fortunate to meet a man by the name of Nathan Prilliman, who's a good friend to this day, who's an established composer and film score composer, you know, in and of himself. But he actually is a teacher there now, but was really the cornerstone of that department. And so he kind of led me into the programs at Juilliard and all the possibilities of what you could do there. But, you know, getting into film scoring, you know, it's something that I'm still learning to this day. You know, I definitely still make the majority of my living performing and definitely want to shift it more into a compositional focus. It's my understanding, based on a lot of my friends who compose scores and a lot of people that I've met that actually make full-time living, you know, doing it, that it really seems to be a combination of making yourself known, making what you do very clear in terms of your style, and also a good amount of luck. It seems that the film scoring world is kind of like you spend your time doing all these kind of lower rung cues, you know, independent films, shorts, stuff like that. And eventually, you know, as you get more experienced, hopefully one of those films gets picked up and maybe wins an award at a prestigious festival like Sundance. And then people see that film, they hear the score, they see that it's won awards. Oh, that, you know, who did that music? I should reach out to him. And it kind of just slowly builds from one single project and kind of snowballs into a full career, is the way that I've kind of interpreted it. Another side of it, which you're seeing more and more these days, is people are actually valuing performing musicians in the film scoring world more than people that come out of conservatories with traditional composition degrees, because I think that performers have a unique perspective into kind of the natural flow of a narrative, because we're forced to deal with the flow of a narrative, you know, from a beat to beat relationship when we play. And so, you know, to really stretch that out and make it into a full, you know, score is something that maybe comes naturally in terms of phrasing to a musician more so than someone who's specifically only focused on composition. So, you know, you're seeing a lot of scores these days that are done by people that it's either their first film score or the director was a fan of their music before they even, you know, made themselves known as a composer for film. And that's really cool, because I think you're getting some really non-traditional stuff happening that, you know, maybe kind of breaks the mold of what a film score, quote unquote, should or shouldn't be. And so, you know, it really adds this whole mixed bag of repertoire into the scoring world that I think is really, really cool. So the short answer is there's no one door to walk through, no one path to follow to get into film scoring. It's kind of a mixed bag, and you kind of have to forge your own path, because, you know, it's not like a typical job or situation where you go for a specific degree, you meet contacts, you have the degree, you have the credentials, so now you get the work. It's like, no, it doesn't really work that way. And it's very, very based on independent relationships that you have between directors and producers. And, you know, you never know who's going to recommend you for what. And I've gotten work through contacts of contacts of contacts just from one positive experience that I had with a director. And so, you know, it really, there's no one path by any means.
Well, this is really just a testament that everyone should always be nice to anyone they ever meet ever, because you
I
might get a
agree.
film scoring opportunity for it.
Absolutely.
Awesome. Well, so that is all so fascinating to hear because obviously I know nothing about this stuff. But that's why I thought it was really fun to reach out to you for this because I know that this is your world and I fully trusted you to like run with my ideas. And so I kind of wanted to go back in time and think about what it was that you went through with this whole composing thing for, this podcast music. So to give context to everybody here listening, I hired Shimmy here, or Dan Shimolinsky, sorry. I hired Dan to compose original music for me because it was important for me to have this podcast feel as legitimate as possible. And I wanted it to have an identity of its own. So I called up Shimmy and I said, "Hey, this is something I'd like to do. This is kind of the vibe I'm hoping I can achieve." And I kind of had you run with it. But we had a meeting at a breakfast spot in our hometown because we were both home for something. I can't even remember. It was probably like a holiday or something like that. Oh,
Something
it
like that.
was,
Yeah, I
because
think
I
so.
started this podcast like very fast.
Yeah.
And so what was going through your head when I first, reached out to you and gave you kind of what I was thinking in terms of sound ideas.
Yeah, so I mean, having worked with a lot of different directors and people on scoring projects, I'm often faced with different levels of understanding in terms of what people want. Sometimes people have no idea, and I have to be open to working with that and kind of help steer them in a direction or get some feedback from them subliminally. Like, they may not know that they want a whole piece to be, brass centric or, horn centric, that kind of thing. But like, based on the words that they're using, powerful, prowess, regal, I can kind of suss that out. And so, half of my job is, before I even put pen to paper, I have to translate what you're saying to me into musical ideas and instruments that mean those things to me, because that's my voice, is how I'm interpreting what you're giving me. And you were really, really clear in terms of what you wanted. You had examples of themes of other things that you liked. You said key words. I believe regal and stately were two words that you said you definitely wanted, but you wanted to
Love
have,
Stately.
yeah, and but you wanted it to have a positive, kind of a positive and optimistic feel. And so, instantly when I hear words like that, I'm thinking, okay, horns, maybe snare drum, major key, definitely, and kind of trying to sculpt your words into an image of what I perceive you want, right? And I'm always very open with the people that I work with. I'm always like, if I come up with a sample of something and you hate it, or you have a visceral reaction one way or another to what I send you, like, I want to know that because it's going to help me ultimately get to something that works for both of us. And I am by no means claiming that I'm like a one-hit wonder, right? Like, I'm not saying that like right off the bat I'm going to nail exactly what your vision is, but I try. And I try to stick with an avenue so that it's not, a lot of times you'll hear scores that really kind of, to me, come off as really ambiguous and not really specific to an emotion. I think because it's really easy to create music that's fundamentally boring and kind of safe. And you hear a lot of things that kind of fall into that category for me, at least personally. And ultimately you end up getting scores that, yeah, the director's cool with, and that's what it's going to be, but no one's really passionate about it, and it just kind of serves the purpose. And that's what I'm trying to stay away from as a composer. And when we talked, I definitely got the sense, okay, she wants, big brass, definitely snare drum. I knew that I wanted to implement live musicians into it. And there's just kind of a sort of simpatico that I feel with certain people, you included, that really made me clear on what you wanted the direction of this to be. And so I think we only went through like maybe two or three revisions before we kind of arrived at the final product, which, for me is a total success. I think anything short of a complete restart is a success for me,
Right. And like, as you're saying, not ambiguous. I think it's really important that we mentioned the like catchiness of the beginning part of it, right?
Yeah.
The like dun 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 dun. Like
Exactly.
many people I know have also said that that's like annoyingly catchy and in their brain after listening to it. So how do you,
Good.
yeah, exactly. And that's not the ambiguous thing that you were talking about. So
Right.
what, I guess like, I know it's gonna be hard for you to like put the words out there for like
Yeah.
what you are thinking about how you're doing that, but how are you create, like, how do you create a catchy jingle, right? Like
Yeah,
it, I'm sure it is easy to come up with an ambiguous, just like the, you know, C, G, A chord progression shindig we all
Right.
hear, but how did you like come up with a catchy thing that gets stuck in my head? Like, what are the fundamentals behind that?
So catchy was one of the first things you mentioned to me as like a cornerstone of what you wanted it to be. And I remembered that and I said, okay, so in my approach, if it being catchy is a primary concern, a goal, then I know that I'm going to start with melody, right? Because by definition, harmony can't really be catchy. It can be catchy when you put harmony to a catchy rhythm, but for me, when I hear catchy, I'm like, okay, the melody has to be strong and it has to be short too, because it has to be digestible, right? It's hard to have a catchy melody that's, 80 bars in length because the human, ear memory
You were
can't
just not,
really.
yeah, we're not into that anymore.
Yeah, so I was thinking, okay, what kind of motif can I come up with, right? And so motivic development is something that's really big in terms of what I'm trying to do as a composer. And my favorite composers all worked heavily with motif and developing a motif. So, motif is basically an idea. It's a small, short musical fragment. So, the classic example is, da, 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 da. Like that's everybody
Oh
knows
yeah,
that,
I was
right?
just thinking dun 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 dun
Yeah.
dun from
For
Indiana Jones.
sure.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So yeah, that kind of stuff is really central to scoring and establishing a brand and establishing recognizability in your own work. And so I think the it's there's no magic formula to coming up with a catchy melody. My approach personally is I will try my hardest to not think about the melody while I'm listening to all the examples that you give me, while I'm looking at all the notes of things that you've mentioned that are important, and then I'll just kind of let it marinate in my brain, in my ear. And it could be something as simple as like taking a walk, going on a run, taking a shower, where I'll just start to kind of hum things to myself. And that really is like, okay, if I can establish an image of what you want in my brain, if I can let it marinate, let it resonate with me, and then I can hum something that I personally can't get out of my head, then I know it's something that's worthwhile in terms of exploring, right? So that boom, da, 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 that's it. That came, I think I came up with that. You caught me actually on the road. I was doing a driving tour. I don't know if you remember this with a band, and I think I was in the car driving, and I think I at our next stop, I just pulled over and pulled out the phone and I made a voice memo of me saying that. And then when I got home that night, I said, great, now that we have this really catchy thing, how can we expand this? And you'll notice it starts very simple. It's just with the piano, and then it kind of spawns into this whole more complex orchestration. And then you have counter melodies, like there's a really beautiful viola melody in there, which is doo 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 doo, that kind of a thing. And then you've got the horn that kind of comes in. And so there are melodies that can come from a central idea later on to keep the listener engaged that may fortify your remembering that catchy initial part. And the development is what keeps you interested, right? So if I present you with an idea and that entices you to listen to it, then everything afterward has to be kind of reinforcing that idea. And so for me, it's like it all starts with that original catchy melody. And some compositions I do start with harmony. Some compositions I do start with instrumentation. But if catchy is a cornerstone of what you want, then I have to start with some kind of short fragment or little piece of melody.
Yeah, so that like everyone, so again, so that everyone knows, what I told Shimmy was I wanted something stately, I wanted something catchy, and that represented this brand, right? It wasn't just gonna be like your standard podcast, like any person pops out a podcast during quarantine. I wanted this to be something that could be long lasting and kind of like the news, but also kind of not like the news.
Yeah.
And Shimmy had sent me some different like tunes and melodies from different TV shows, like House of Cards was one. And I was like, this is a little too dark for me. Like, I like the news. I like the political aspect of it. Again, the drums, the horns, I like that kind of, again, stately idea behind it. But I didn't want it to be negative. I wanted it to be, if anything, neutral, right? Like neutral to positive. And you're right. I like that it has the really isolated part of the beginning where it's just like the bells chime piano thing. But then it does build. It has like a pause, and then it's like, oh, this is all the things. And I think you did a really good job of pulling that all together. And so you said that it has some live performers, live instrumentation. Can you tell me what was live versus what's not live? Because I don't think I could tell if you were to tell me.
So, you know, with the advents,
technology these days.
I was trying to avoid that. But
with technology these days, this is this is how amazing things can sound without real humans.
Unfortunately, that's true. So, you know, with scoring specifically, we're seeing a movement towards sample-based production, which means that literally, you know, you have these giant companies that create instruments, virtual instruments that incorporate actual recordings of actual musicians. And, you know, what they'll do is they'll have these musicians sit there and they'll have them play every note on every part of their instrument and every different articulation and compile that into an instrument that you as a composer can play. So I own a great deal of these instruments because it's important that I can send you something that, you know, on the road is going to be representative of the final product and, you know, kind of gives you an idea for the palette that I'm going for without having to stop everything I'm doing and hire a musician for every time you want to hear a change to the development of it. And so, you know, I often create a sample-based version of what I'm going for that kind of uses these instruments. And then if the budget allows, if the time allows, I like to hire live musicians to replace those parts. And so, you know, there are certain things where the samples are so good that I don't feel I really need to. So, you know, I'm really pleased with the brass instrument, you know, samples that I have. So the brass in there is not a live musician, but, you know, snare drum is one of those things where, you know, yeah, the sample is fine, but, you know, I happen to have a, you know, snare drum player from a major orchestra that lives a block away. So, you know, why would I not call him and get him into my, you know, little makeshift closet studio and say, hey, can you lay down some snare on this? Because I know whatever he's going to do is going to be more organic than whatever the sample allows me to do or whatever I can come up with. Because, you know, I recognize that I'm not a snare drum, you know, percussion aficionado. You know, I can only kind of just gesture in terms of what I want them to do and let them take it from there. And so when you use live players, it just gives a different organic, you know, original sound to the project. And so that was very important for me. So a couple instruments where I had viola come in because that was an important line for me in the theme. So I had a violist record, I had a cellist record, and then I think I had violin too. I can't remember, but that might have been sample based. But the three main instruments that I knew I needed was cello, because, you know, you have those kind of fifths, those open fifths that really resonate. And so, you know, I have a cello player that I love and work with all the time that, you know, lives just down the street from me. And so, you know, being in New York and having gone to Juilliard and having all these contacts of musicians that are super high caliber is really, really important for me and what I do, because, you know, it's not a matter of, you know, who should I call for this, or, you know, can I get them? It's, I'm going to shoot him a text message and see if he can come over and do this. And, you know, that really, to me, makes the whole thing just sound so much better, because no matter how good your virtual instruments are, nothing replicates a real human being in a booth with their instrument, listening to what you've created and having them play on top of it. And so that was important for me in terms of the creation of this one.
So then how do you direct that? When you do, you just ask them to play it just how they hear it in the sample, or is there even any direction that goes along with it? Because I'm sure that they're not going to just be like, here's my spin on this piece you've composed for this, lowly girls podcast in Chicago.
Well, but kind of there is. I mean, I typically do multiple takes, and you know, I start off by saying, listen to the reference that I created, and can you do your best version of that, kind of smoothing over the shall we say, bumps in the road of, you know, what I'm limited to as a sample creation sound. And so I typically get a couple takes of that. And then I say, you know, how are you feeling? The great thing about having a musician in the booth is, you know, I can ask them questions, I can direct them, I can say, can you do a little more of this, a little more of that? And so it's like, you know, the samples are great, but I kind of equate it to like, you know, you can go to H&M and get a perfectly fine suit that's going to last you for some duration of time, but it doesn't beat like a tailored high quality suit, right? And so, you know, for me, that's what I'm doing when I have a live musician is I'm tailoring it to my vision. And so I'm able to say things to them to kind of shape what they're doing. And then typically the last couple takes that I have them do, I say, okay, just give me something out of the box. Give me something that you're, you know, as you were going through this, what did you feel was missing in terms of your vision and your artistic, you know, how would you approach this if you heard this and I gave you no instruction? And so, you know, the great thing about having digital, you know, tracking and being able to do this all on the computer is we can do as many takes as we want. And I can choose from within those takes. So let's say the majority of the take where I told them specifically what to do is what I want to go with. But in that last take, they did some kind of fill or some kind of articulation that really resonates with the overall message of what I want to convey with the piece. I can grab that from that take and put it into the other take. And so, you know, I have this control that really allows me to fine tune everything that's happening so that it's serving the purpose of the original goals that, you know, the director or whoever's hiring me wants to establish. And it can be something as small as like, oh, they decided to do an up bow here instead of a down bow, which I had been telling them to do on the other takes, you know, and it sounds so much more natural. And so, you know, there's nothing beating a live musician in the booth, you know, listening to your comments and just kind of putting their own spin on it as well.
Did they do anything crazy with this? Like, is there anything that just did not make the editing cuts that would just be hilarious to say?
Oh, always. Yeah. I mean, you know, I think I had the cellist, you know, I said on the last take, I think we had gotten so many takes of cello that I was like, okay, I'm going to take away the music that I wrote for you. You've done this a million times. Don't play what I wrote. Just, you know, even if it's some kind of percussive element or something, just give me something out of the box. And sometimes that goes really, really well. Even if it's like one single beat that like I can grab and put somewhere else in the score, or, you know, something that I can keep on my computer and use for a score later. Like it kind of always, you know, brings interesting stuff, but typically that stuff doesn't get used. And when the final product's done, it's pretty comical to look back on.
Be like, you guys are all crazy. I only have two more things for you.
Yeah.
I think the first one is, you know, when it comes to composing, like you said, you're a bassist, but how did you, like, do you have to learn all the instruments? I think that's the thing that I get kind of wrapped up with is, mm-hmm. how do you know every single instrument or what would go well in a piece? Because you're not an expert in every instrument,
right?
Unless you are, feel free to correct me, but
no,
you're
I'm,
not, right?
I'm definitely, so, definitely not. And
okay.
That's a lifelong process. You know, I'm constantly paying attention to scores that I like and sounds that I like, and looking deeper into how it was achieved, you know, so blending between instruments is a big field in terms of, you know, timbres and what you can, you know, accomplish in terms of just like, oh, how does a trumpet and a flute sound together? How does a cello and a vocalist sound together? You know, there's just all these different combinations that produce super unique sounds. And then you get to the digital side of it, which is, okay, if I use this kind of reverb or this kind of compressor, you know, it's endless. And so, you know, I am always trying to act as a sponge. And, you know, I have friends that are, you know, I'm really fortunate to have super high quality, you know, just
friends
massive,
and contacts.
Yeah,
and all
yeah,
that just, yeah.
Just, you know, are, you know, for lack of a better term, badasses who just kind of, you know,
yeah.
know the ins and outs of their instruments. And so I often will ask them, you know, after a project's done, if it's something that I've composed for film or if it's one of my groups, I'll say, you know, is there something I could have done better? Or, you know, what's annoying about the way that I wrote this for you? Or, you know, what would be appreciated next time I write music for this instrument? You know, and I get so many comments, and, you know, people are typically pretty polite, but, you know, the minute you ask them to be completely honest with you, they will, you know, it's New York. So I definitely get my fair share of criticism and I always learn from it. And, you know, I'm always trying to find new sounds and get to new dimensions on each instrument. And so I do not claim to be an expert on all instruments. And there are, I'm sure, some amazing capabilities of instruments that I'm not using just simply because I don't know about it yet. And that's what's exciting is, you know, as I go back to what I was saying about how it relates to bass playing, you know, bass players give context to the band from beat to beat. I am, you know, controlling what's happening between instruments. I am supporting when my support is needed. I am pulling back when it's not. And, you know, it's this constant ebb and flow of how can I contribute positively to this band and make the whole unit sound better. With film scoring, it's exactly the same thing. I'm serving your narrative. I'm serving your story. I'm trying to tell your story with music and support you when, you know, the narrative needs most support and staying out of the way when it doesn't. And so, you know, there are so many different ways that you can do that with film scoring, and choice of instruments is probably the number one way. No matter what melody I write, the unique timbre that an instrument can get to is something that I'm still learning about. And so, you know, I would be ignorant to not keep my ears open to new sounds and you know, new possibilities, because the more I learn about other instruments, the wider my palette grows and the wider my arsenal of sounds grows. And so, you know, I work a lot with synthesizers too and electronic music. And that's something that I've gotten into over the past 4 or 5 years and gotten really passionate about. And so, you know, it's endless. There's live instruments, there's electronic instruments, there's production tricks, there's just, you can do anything to serve the narrative. And so, you know, for me as a bass player, that's super enticing because I get to do the thing that I love about bass playing with a palette that is quite literally endless.
Dang, that is so cool and also very overwhelming because I'm not going to claim to be a music expert either, but I was like the choir nerd in school and my mom always made us go to the symphonies. And mm-hmm. Now as an adult, I'm like, oh, I actually do appreciate the symphony, even though Absolutely. As a kid, I hated it.
Yeah.
But like, those are things I just don't think about. I'm just like, wow, it sounds so pretty. Well, thank you so much again for chatting with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
And where can people like find you, hire you? What should they look out for when it comes to your work? Yeah. I know you just have like a bajillion things, so feel free to plug away.
Well, I'm probably most active on Instagram and you can find me at Shimmy on the Bass, and that's Chimy. And that's my website as well, shimmyonthebass.com. And yeah, in terms of my work, you know, right now, I'm working on an upcoming feature film with a director in London named Josh Kidd, who I really like, and actually had a film that's doing really well and winning some awards called Nectar. It's an independent feature film that's making the rounds for the festivals this summer. And yeah, so you can find out information about that. I'm on IMDb. I'm on Twitter, Facebook, all that stuff. So if you just search me out, I'm pretty, but most active on Instagram. So definitely find me there.
Cool. I can't claim to have any like major feature film people listening, but I hope that someone knows someone who knows someone who can hire you. So thanks so much again for chatting with us.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to this episode of First 100 Days. Original music by Dan Chmielinski, and feel free to tell your friends. Bye, y'all.